Welcome to Preaching Podcasts for Those Who Proclaim Publicly, a weekly podcast from the Stevenson School of Ministry, where we take a look at the lectionary from diverse and unique perspectives to help prepare church leaders, church educators, and pundits for Sunday worship and other speaking events. I'm your host, Deirdre Good, and with me today is Althea Spencer-Miller and Josh Davis. So today we're going to discuss readings from the first Sunday of Advent for December 2019. And it's the traditional start of the church year for many denominations. And the readings are oriented in that way. It may be that liturgies, worship services are also oriented in that fashion. And of course, it's out of sync with the calendar year because we're not at the beginning of a new year, at least in the Western calendar. So the readings come from Isaiah 2 and Psalm 122 and the Epistle to the Romans, chapter 13, and finally a kind of apocalyptic chapter from Matthew 24, the Gospel. And this is the start of Matthew featured prominently in the lectionary cycle. We don't start at the beginning of Matthew, we start with Matthew 24, because the mood, the rhythm of the church year for Advent is one of preparation for Sundays, of preparation for the holy season of Christmas, which vies with Easter as one of the two great liturgies of the liturgical cycle. We could have a discussion sometime about whether birth or death, birth or resurrection, you know, can you have one without the other? But the orientation of this Sunday is for the beginning of the church year, so liturgy and readings reflect that. The collect, the prayer for this Sunday, is about asking God to give us grace to cast away the works of darkness and put on the armor of light. And here comes now in the time of this mortal life in which your Son Jesus Christ came to visit us in great humility, that in the last day when he shall come again in his glorious majesty to judge both the living and the dead, we may rise to the life immortal. So preparation for the birth of Jesus, God's Son, and the language of apocalyptic is prefatory to that. Maybe I could also, while I have the microphone just for a second, point out that in the context of Advent, rejoicing, as the psalm indicates, I was glad, Psalm 22, verse 1, I was glad when they said to me, let us go to the house of the Lord. So it's not all doom and gloom and preparation. There's a lot of rejoicing in the preparation of what is going to be a joyful feast. And light. There's a great deal of light in Advent, which is what the prayer is about. And so Jerusalem as a city built on a hill, Psalm 122, verse 3, is a place that is visible, a place that stands out, as it were, something visible to all surrounding it. It's high. We look up to Jerusalem, the holy city. So there are not only these tones of preparation and repentance, but also these notions of light and the visibility of places where we see God's blessing. I also want to mention that in churches in a northern clime, like a lot of Western Europe, in spite of climate crisis that we're all now experiencing, Advent can be given over to carol services at which complete services are given over for 4 week Sundays to the celebration and singing of carols. And what's wonderful about that is that people darken the doors of churches that never come otherwise to church. They want to hear familiar sounds, they want to sing familiar songs, they want to make music and rejoice. It's an occasion where we see people that we might not otherwise see in churches, sort of like weddings and, alas, funerals. So there's lots going on in the lectionary readings here.
I was struck when I at the connection between this passage from Isaiah and the apocalyptic tone of the Matthew 24, not in contrast to one another, but actually in their complementarity. I think it's interesting that, and it's a theme that we've visited a couple of times recently, which is the way in which the desire and yearning for peace is also connected with the, you know, the overcoming of those things that hinder peace.
Yeah.
And I was struck too by the well, not the final verse, but the nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. And I remembered that one of the translations is study war. You should study war no more. And I was thinking about the other connections with Torah here and God teaching. And I don't know what the word is here with learn or study, but I do think it's fascinating to consider the contrast that's in this Isaiah passage between, you know, the Lord teaching his ways that we may walk in his paths, as the passage says, and no longer studying war anymore, no longer learning war or you know, after having beat your swords into plowshares and your spears into hooks, because there's no longer any need for such a thing anymore. And the connection with the idea of Torah or teaching and instruction, I thought that was, it really jumped out to me as reading in reading over these passages.
Yep.
It's as always, I find the lectionary neighborliness of texts to be very intriguing, the way they are put together. And if I might be a bit contrastive and at the same time, hopefully complimenting you both, I'm thinking with Deirdre's highlighting of it's time to cast away the works of darkness, and wondering about the peoples who first heard these passages or heard these passages in those original contexts and communities, and their conditions as they heard it. You know, what were the works of darkness that they were contending with, rather? The way eschatology appears in the Isaiah passage, in the Romans passage, in the Matthew passage, there's a bit of difference in the orientation to the world. So I find the Isaiah 2 passage, yes, there's going to be a radical transformation, but when that transformation occurs, not only will there be war no more, there'll be an absence of war, the instruments of war will be turned into instruments of, let's say, agricultural productivity and so on. But then there's a notion that this despised place, this mountain of the Lord's house that has been in dereliction, that has been subsumed by the warring factions of the world, will, in this vision, that will become the center of the universe. So for these Isaiah folk, the prophet Isaiah, the outcome of these dark times will be a magnificent elevation of these peoples, accompanied by a desire and a yearning for peace. I'm going to stop there for the moment, because it's interesting, by contrast, the kind of inbreaking that happens in Matthew.
There is narratively speaking, in Matthew, there is a narrative miasma, put it like that. So when Matthew's section in chapter 24 begins, the miasma begins in, as the days of Noah were, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. And then there's a description of the days of Noah, the days in the past, as in those days before the flood. And here we get participles, eating and drinking and marrying and giving in marriage until the day that Noah entered the ark. And then they knew nothing until the flood came and swept them all away. So there's a life continuing sense of the first part of those sentences, and then suddenly there's something that changes. It's the flood. The flood comes and sweeps all aside, and then life becomes completely differently oriented. And that's the description of the coming of the Son of Man, in which there are two in the field and one is left and one is taken, and two women grinding meal and one is taken and the other will be left. So it, narratively speaking, it's a completely different literary type of effect than the psalm of joy and the words, the invocation of the prophet Isaiah, come, let us go to the mountain of the Lord, this invitation to collectively gather. And it's completely different than the language in Romans 13, where we get the reference to works of darkness. And in that context, Althea, they're connected with reveling and drunkenness. Not so much, yeah, a different connotation, not so much deprivation, but rather excessive actions and so on. And of course, Paul's language here in Romans, as a culmination of everything Paul ever wrote to a community to which he'd never been, the language about continence and sophrosune, self-control, is language that's designed to separate followers of Jesus from other practitioners of different sorts of devotions to gods. In other words, the continence that characterizes these early Jesus followers, most of whom are Jews, is a kind of a self-control that presents a face to the world, which is different. It's different. It's distinctive. And Paul just doesn't advocate it because for its own sake. Paul thinks that by being continent, by being self-controlled, the followers of Jesus, to whom he has gone around in the Mediterranean world, to whom he has preached first and then written letters in many and diverse forms, those followers, because of their purity, and this is the language of holiness and purity in Romans 13, they will be able to bring about some radical reorientation of the world to God. It may be that it will be in Jerusalem at the temple. We don't know, but this is the purpose of Paul's mission. You know, this is not 19th century Christian evangelism. You know, this is not going with Albert Schweitzer. This is designed to inculcate a collective action of God's new presence in the world based on the holiness of believers to bring about the Messiah's presence.
Yeah, I'm nodding my head, and I know you can't see me nodding it. It's not reflecting so much on the psalm, but Romans, Matthew, and Isaiah are as texts that are erupting from some form of miasma or other. Mm-hmm. And another thing that you said earlier, Deirdre, was about can you have resurrection without birth? Can you have death without birth? And it reminded me of one of our little truisms. In the midst of life there is death, and its converse, that in the midst of death there is life. And if we put those two together somehow, I think of the world as it is now. I just read earlier, I don't know if it's a true report, an accurate report, but the report was saying that Brazil has rejected any assistance for the burning Amazon. And that is just heartbreaking in this time. I'm thinking about the clash that we're actually living through when liberal democracy is on the fault line. It's hanging on the petard, so to speak. And the rise of a rigorous, robust populism, with what liberals like myself think of as its bigotry, its animosities, its real anger against the oppressiveness of liberal democratic rule. And so this challenge, and here we are living in this crooks kind of time, and we don't know what is to come. And thinking about it as our own time of death. So are these passages just sort of useless optimisms based in no reality, or do they have in their various ways of responding to their own rigors, is this a kind of attestation where hope has to exist in the midst of desolation? A hope for something that is better than what exists at this time. You know, is that how these passages speak to us?
Yeah.
It does seem like the Matthew passage that, be ready for the Son of Man is coming at an unexpected hour, does seem to place the eschatological transformation that we see anticipated in Isaiah for sure, and as Deirdre, you were pointing out too, as is also a part of the Romans passage in Paul, that there's an element of loss and destruction that Jesus's words here in Matthew seem to precede that transformation. Is that a fair characterization? I mean, because he's saying, they'll be eating and drinking and marrying and giving in marriage, but it'll be like Noah's Ark, where it just kind of creeps up on them.
Yep.
And it is something joyful to anticipate, but it doesn't come without turmoil. I don't know exactly what the right word is. I'm also thinking of Romans. Yeah. Romans 6, maybe not Romans 6. Well, Romans 6, that you're buried with Christ in his death, and it's the baptism. Mm-hmm. But Romans 8 also has the travail passage. All of creation is groaning in anticipation of the revelation of the children of God. So I think you're exactly right. I think I'm thinking through these passages now, colored by your mentioning of the Amazon fires, Althea, and all of that, something to definitely bear in mind. And the people that live in the Amazon who are themselves imperiled by...
Yes.
By
yeah.
Yes. Yes.
Imperiled, and again, reports are coming out, but some of the leaders of the indigenous people, at least there's a report of one who has, it's been thought, murdered. And the speculation is, was he murdered because he stood against Bolsonaro? Is that his name, Bolsonaro?
Right.
So it's a kind of time, we live in the kind of time when events are so bizarre that our suspicions are not untoward. Our suspicions about bizarre secrecies and conspiracies have a lot of fodder. And so the question of how do you find hope almost brings us into affinity with these texts, because you've both been describing the difficulties of the times of these people, and yet there is this thing about hope. But if I could be a little bit disturbing of our use, even my use of the word hope, it's who gets to hold this hope when we're divided? How does this hope resonate or reverberate if, let us say, it was a white supremacist movement speaking these words of hope, how do these words reverberate? If it's a progressive group of folk holding this hope, and how do we negotiate between the two? Because all three passages have this note of Advent hope that, wake from your sleep, salvation is nearer to us now. So don't be put on the obtuseness, the blindness that comes from revelry and drunkenness and debauchery. Mm-hmm. Be awake, be alert. This is not the time to be stupefied and numb your minds. You know, in Matthew 24:36-44, it's a kind of passage that has lent itself to a lot of divisive Christian teaching, that is a faithful kind who will be taken by the graciousness of the Lord, and those who are not taken will be left to endure the earth in its pre-Noadic kind of condition and the punishments that come. But there is hope that a certain kind of person will be rescued from that scenario and others left to suffer. But, you know, some of those who are left to suffer, two will be in the field. They've been working together mm-hmm. in that field mm-hmm. for one goal, a mm-hmm. shared goal, but one is going to be taken and the other is not. There's an irony there. That leaves me a little uncomfortable with the passage and wanting to delve more into what that means for how we understand the relationships and the structures in which we live out our lives. Mm-hmm. And back to the question then of how does hope reverberate in the contexts of differing and often competing interests in our society. I don't want to leave us hopeless, because I'm thinking that this, whatever form of hope we have here, the imprint, the template that I think these passages give us is that no matter how harsh the times, no matter how confounding and confusing, there are dispositions available to us by which we can, or from which we can, receive inspiration, and that these ancestors of ours have left us these records of hope that we access in Advent and bring to focus on the work, the life, the ministry of Jesus.
I mean, I think your words, Althea, I always think of something that, you know, that I learned from reading and paying attention to James Cone a long time ago, which uh-huh. is the, you know, the God is not, your reference to the white supremacist and what this might look like and what hope might look like, you know, and from, yeah, he's always very clear, like, God is not neutral, you know, God is always on the side of the person who is oppressed, the person who is suffering indignity and inhumanity and oppression, I definitely think that that's always something to ponder, and the fact that, and I suppose that's one thing that I actually appreciate in the contrast to these passages, these eschatological or apocalyptic passages. There is the promise of real transformation, but also a recognition that transformation is not easy for some.
There's a way in which especially the Matthew passage makes my heart weep. When we talk about white supremacists, and even those of us caught up in liberal notions of an egalitarian, equitable kind of society with opportunities available for all and our usual social categories characterizations are not functional to prejudge how we allow people access to the goods of life and the good things of life. It's that, you know, when some people will have my head for this, but when a white supremacist has decided that the world is so against them, I ponder their own relationship to the powers that be and the powers that actually created their marginalization, but tell them that that marginalization is because of other poor people like you, other people of color like you, without ever acknowledging their role in maintaining systems that divide all of us needy people from each other, and maintaining systems that not only divide but create enmity amongst us. So that the white supremacist might have equal access to these passages as a person of color, a gay person, equal right to these passages as the persons perceived as their enemies. Persons who perceive the white supremacist as their enemy might have the same rights to these passages. The question is then, how do you understand the sources of your oppression, the sources that make life a miasma for you? And whom do you create solidarities with? If you are awake and watching the moment and reading the time, do you just continue in your divisiveness when Isaiah is begging us to put down our swords and plowshares, not just the macro military systems, but us who fight against each other? Let's put down our swords and plowshares for a moment. Let's put down our swords and pick up plowshares. Let's put down our spears and pick up pruning hooks. Let's see what we can do if that verse is used to bring us together, rather than to see each other as enemies. How will we perceive the commonalities of our oppression? How can we be together in such a way that if two are in the field working together, and I'm going to really be a little tendentious now, but if two are in the field working together, the one who is taken, it's a group of persons who have been disenfranchised, no matter what our disenfranchisement is. And maybe the person who is left behind is a supervisor who maintains a system of evil.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
You know, we all have access and rights to these passages, but do they keep us at loggerheads, or do they beckon to us to come together and be awake?
Yep. I mean, as it points to division, to are separated into one in one place and another in another place. So there is a unity in the ignorance and the unknowing that the passage starts with about when this will be, when it will transpire, is not simply between and amongst two or three people. It's ignorance on the part of angels and the sun. There's no access to anything other than agreeing to keep awake. So that level of not knowing might prompt a different attitude towards what the passages choose to describe as division. If nobody knows, then it shifts the focus away from, you know, waking up and discovering that you've been left and somebody else has been taken.
Yeah.
Perhaps.
Yeah.
What is the purpose of that, Deirdre? What do you take that to be? Clearly it's a terrifying image, but for what purpose?
Well, there's a knowing in Romans, which is the knowing of the present. So there are some things that are known, which is what's in front of you. Salvation is closer than it was. It's closer to us now than when we first became believers. So there's a gradation of knowing, Josh. it's not full knowledge, it's not fully revelatory. So Advent might, if I can then put it back into the liturgical context, might give all of us collectively a chance to reflect together on limited knowledge, limited perception, and alliances with whom, people with whom alliances might be made because of the reality of limited knowing.
Yeah, yeah. It's frightening. Matthew 24, it is frightening. And if you don't know which one you are, it is even more frightening. But I like where the thought is going, because it too has this theme of staying awake. It's time to wake from sleep in Romans. It's time to stay awake if you are the householder, if you are akin to the householder. It's time to be vigilant. And it's all, you know, it's scary work to think that there'll be justice for one group and not for the other. But does staying awake allow you to enter into the kinds of alliances and solidarities that you're talking about, Deirdre? Does a scare factor say, let's not get so frightened that we're paralyzed? Actually, knowing that there's a salvation coming, wake up.
Yep.
Be real.
Yeah.
Does that leave us space then to do the kinds of solidarity work in preparation for? It's not a hopeless situation.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm wanting to keep informed through NGOs' knowledge of indigenous people in Amazonia. Those are the people that I want to be in touch with to tell, not the mainstream media. So, you know, the recognition of limited perspectives prompts me to search and support those organizations that are working with people who are right on the spot of transforming and catastrophic fires. But staying awake is, of course, a plural verb in Matthew's gospel. Keep awake, therefore. It's not about you singular. You know, it's not about you elitist person. You can afford to stay. No. It's about collective staying awake, even in the context of possible separation.
Yeah.
And it's a present tense. So it's not a short-term thing. It's an ongoing long-term thing.
And it sort of, it makes sense, Deirdre, if we might hearken back to Matthew Carter's description of the Matthean community.
Yeah, yeah.
Then it's not a community in the center of power. It's a community on the margins of power, and it is a community. There is a salvation coming. It's near. We don't know when it's going to come. It's going to be this inbreaking, and things will not be the same.
Yep.
So let us stay awake.
Absolutely. We tend to read these texts as if you know we're the triumphalist party, but. You know, these are nobodies. Matthew's community, as Warren Carter points out, is completely marginalized. Completely marginalized. Yeah. Completely. The people who sit in darkness, on them has the light shined, you know, as Isaiah says. But it's quoted at the beginning of Matthew's gospel. So, you know, we are with the Matthean community sitting in darkness. Yeah, that's who we are. That's what Advent's about.
Throughout this conversation, one of the things that I'm also thinking about is like that there is a thread that runs through all of these, and there's a tendency to read the Romans passage in a kind of moralizing fashion. Mm-hmm. But what I'm kind of getting from this is like, this is more like, it's not really a moralizing claim so much as like the kind of commitment that you might expect from someone who is like, say, a revolutionary or something like this. Like, don't you understand what time it is? It's time to commit yourself to the project, to the, yeah. Don't give yourself over to as though everything is going on, you know, everything is just fine. There is a transformative moment to be seized now, and let's give ourselves over to that. Does that seem compelling?
Yes, it does. To me, yes, it does. I think it does, and it captures where Deirdre was pointing us earlier on in the conversation. It was certainly, I heard it implicit in what Deirdre was saying, that you can read this as moralizing, but it's not just moralizing with a denunciatory note for a certain kind of behavior. It's exactly what you're saying, Josh, that this behavior does not serve the project well.
Right. Yes. Like there's an asceticism that's sort of self-preoccupied because yes. It's like things are bad. And then yes. There's like the asceticism of someone like Che Guevara, right? Which is, it's a very different kind of outlook.
Yes. Yeah.
Exactly. There's a self-absorption in internally focused notions of self abnegation. But what we're talking about in Romans is behaving honorably, walking. You could translate this in different ways, but it's a moral concept, trying to avoid public shame by conforming to accepted standards. But so, for example, Socrates accepts the death penalty of the court rather than taking the opportunity to escape because he regards what is decent in the sense of publicly accepted virtue and moral excellence. And so we see a different articulation of public behavior on the part of people who don't behave in recognizably self-aggrandizing ways. To put it like that.
So in a sense, both are there. I mean, the acquiescence to social behavior, but in the context of a fledgling communities that self-perceive as being over against having a measure of dissonance with the dominant society, and even the non-dominant society, knowing themselves to be pursuing a different vision in all the three passages we've talked about, Isaiah 2, 1 to 5, Romans 13, 11 to 14, and Matthew 24, 36 to 44. In those communities, it's exemplary, yes, but it works for survival in the light of a hope that is before them. And I wanted to make one last connection, and it's to point out, akin to Deirdre's plural, the Isaiah passage is not about an individual doing something or having something happen to them. Mm. It's a collective. It's a people who have a sense of being joined together by a particular covenant formed into a particular peoples. And this is their dream that they're holding on to, and while I'm not wanting to support a contemporary notion of nationalism, a current notion of nationalism in our time, what I do want to point out that this is not just for singular individuals to benefit from. It's that coming together, it's that sense of belonging to each other in particular ways that I think creates the circumstances in which vision can be actualized.
Very helpful. Very helpful. Okay. I think this is a good occasion to stop. Besides, we will not be stopping the themes of Advent. We will be continuing for three more Sundays before Christmas to reflect on these apocalyptic themes and the themes of end times. So I look forward to our next conversation, and I thank you both immensely for this conversation. And I hope your lives are relatively calm in the days ahead. Thank you.
We're gonna stay awake.
Thank you, all. Yeah.
Thank you,
Josh. Thank you, Deirdre.
Okay. Bye-bye. See you next time.
Blessing.
Bye-bye. Yeah. Bye-bye.